welcome back to Cairo Nights. This was a project, I think I may have even mentioned this last week on air, by the New York Times, along with some partner news agencies. It's called Out of Work in America. It's this remarkable look at a handful of people in the United States who are dealing with the dual blows of being out of work and also dealing with a pandemic. Joining me right now is Clinton Cargill. He's the assistant national editor of the New York Times. He edited and coordinated this project. Clinton, thank you for joining Cairo Nights.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks so much for having me.
So when I read this piece, and immediately I got this sort of really, I mean, as a longtime journalist and a former newspaper journalist, I always get two things happening. I get really impressed with good writing, and I also get this kind of wave of jealousy, like, oh, this was such so spot on. This is exactly what more people should be doing. Can you tell me a little bit about the conception of what you were trying to accomplish here with Out of Work in America?
Sure, absolutely. We have a weekly meeting, you know, what we call our enterprise meeting, where we come up with story ideas on Wednesdays. And like most companies, I think for us in March, that transitioned to conversations over video conferencing. And we were, I think the editors on the national desk were all very much in the throes of figuring out how pandemic life was going to be for ourselves. And as the news of the just incredible loss of jobs broke, we were trying to find a way to get at that story longer term. It's so often the case that we are chasing a story to get to a deadline or over the course of a day or a couple of days. And we knew this just from recent experience. I think, you know, many editors in those meetings were at the times during the Great Recession or at other news organizations, and really understood that unemployment is a long-term problem in a recession of that scale. And so we just really wanted to find ways to hear from people directly over time, which is a little bit different from how we usually work.
Exactly. The idea is sometimes you jump in there, you get a reaction to an immediate event, and then you never talk to that person again. And this is something pretty different than that.
Absolutely. And I think our experience is very colored by, you know, again, just things we've learned from the Great Recession. People, in many cases, never recover the like their lifetime earning potential is permanently altered by long-term unemployment. There are people, you know, if your home is foreclosed on, that's like the markets come back up. But what happens at the individual scale has really far-reaching implications. We wanted to get at some of that detail and really see how people were faring as, you know, some states opened up, as some industries like retail, hospitality, travel were, you know, just really hit hard. We wanted to, like, get at those stories in a more granular way. And also, I think, kind of get out of the way of the voices of the people who were living it. So that was kind of what made us decide an as-told-to format was really the way to tell these stories.
We're talking with Clinton Cargill. He's the assistant national editor of the New York Times, and their project is Out of Work in America. They have visited, let me give you the list of cities where they visited, and they worked with 11 news outlets to coordinate these stories. Buffalo, Victoria, Texas, Frenchtown, Montana, Carlisle, Pennsylvania, Grand Rapids, Michigan, Sarasota, Florida, Tucson, Arizona, Eau Claire, Wisconsin, Santa Ana, California. I was happy I got that one correct. Augusta, Georgia, Las Vegas, and Owensboro, Kentucky. When you did, now were these cities picked for specific reasons that they represent something as far as unemployment and likelihood of reemployment, or were they picked because they had really strong characters that that you felt like represented what it is like, you know, sort of in the middle of the pandemic?
Mm-hmm. We made decisions by state initially. So we were looking at state unemployment levels in April and May, and because it's an election year and politics is, you know, inflects so much of what's happening across the country. We also wanted to look at places where people's economic fortunes might have an impact on how they were going to vote. So we really chose states that had high unemployment rates with a mix of battlegrounds and then just wanting a broad geographic distribution. So, for example, in Montana, we were looking to tell a story about how the unemployment process was playing out there, which might be very different from a city like Las Vegas, which has basically been crippled because its primary industry is tourism.
Right, right. That makes sense. And when you, so let's talk a bit about some of the specifics. So in each of these, for listeners who have not yet read the stories, and I would strongly encourage you to, in each of these cities, essentially it is a person telling sort of the initial blow that came from the unemployment and pandemic, and then revisiting these people and finding out, well, how are you doing now? How are you doing now? Let's talk specifically about Victoria, Texas. And we have Marina Moya, who is 24 years old, had a baby on the way when she lost her $18 an hour gig at a Caterpillar heavy equipment manufacturing factory. How did this particular story, all of the stories struck me quite personally, but this particular story, when you talk to her, she's obviously at a moment of fairly extraordinary stress. She sounds very sort of matter of fact and really sort of resolute in the story. Can you tell me a little bit about your reaction to listening to her and then reading the story?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think she comes across as being someone who just really is going to make it work. And that piece was reported by Callie Venable at the Victoria Advocate, one of our local newsroom partners. And when we first heard from her, as you say, she was expecting a baby, had been laid off. Her husband was furloughed for a period of time. And there's a detail in the story that just kills me. They had a blowout on their, one of the tires on their car blew out. And so just in the midst of, losing your second income, first income is also on hold. And here's an unforeseen expense that might be $100, $150, but that really illustrates what happens to people who are unemployed. It's one unforeseen expense kind of throws all your plans off course. And yet she looks at her situation and feels like she's been very lucky to have, time. I think she was on bed rest at a certain point with her pregnancy. So she, her point of view is that starting a family, she really needed that time. And, she's doing some retraining to be a nail technician. So I think this is a very resilient person, and I myself grew up in Texas, and it's a very kind of Texas point of view about how you deal with hardship. I would just say that, as life events, those are all really serious things to be dealing with, and she's so sanguine about it.
Yeah, she's remarkable about it, actually.
Yeah. I was also really struck by Oscar Elejosanz in Tucson. He was, accepted into this advanced certification program to be a certified sommelier, and really saw a career path for himself in hospitality. He was also working at a wine distributor in Arizona. I'm going to say that part again. He was also working as a wine distributor in Tucson. And his experience of this pandemic has been that he can't rely on that industry anymore at all. So he's thinking about a complete career change. And that so moves me. You know, I think there's every reason to believe that people are making the best choice for themselves. But at the same time, it's hard to hear about somebody who has had to, you know, really kind of recalibrate their dreams and expectations because they've hit such a hard patch.
We're talking with Clinton Cargill. He's the assistant national editor of the New York Times. He oversaw the project Out of Work in America. They visited 11 cities through 11 local news outlets to write the stories about people dealing with the double blow of both pandemic and losing their job. Let's move to Las Vegas real quickly. The Las Vegas thing is a particularly unusual city in that it was one of the, it is essentially a company town for tourism. I mean, it would be difficult to find a city in America less prepared than, not less prepared in terms of like healthcare resources, but less prepared in terms of just economic base for a pandemic like such as this than Las Vegas. It is a city that completely went into free fall mode. We're focusing on Neri Martinez in this particular story. When you were looking at this story, Clinton, and when you were editing this story, what do you think that the lesson from Mr. Martinez and Las Vegas is? Because, again, when I saw this package, I thought, oh, man, this is going to really make me pretty depressed and pretty sad for people. But I also found that people are kind of spectacularly tough in this environment as well. And it seems like that was part of the story that was being told here.
Absolutely. Yeah. Neri and a few others really, really focused on, you know, how much support they find from family. And I found that to be a commonality among a lot of the stories that is very touching and human. And so I think it's a given that a story about 12 unemployed people is going to have some hard chapters. But I also thought his just real desire to be back at work is so classically American. I just want to get back to work. And I think that and the kind of relationship to family are particularly part of his story. Although there's other elements, which is that, you know, he has been down this road before. He talks about the fact that they lost their home in the Great Recession. And so, you know, the issue of unemployment is not at all new and is something that they've, you know, got experience with. And I thought that was very poignant. He's one of like many thousands of workers in that economy that whose lives are just on hold.
Absolutely. And not only on hold, I mean, it's unclear to what level Las Vegas is going to come back, because it's sort of its dual, if for people who don't know, its dual income essentially is both the gambling and the tourism industry, but it's also the convention industry is a mm-hmm. massive driver there. And the convention industry really does help fund that town. And who knows every convention center in America, everybody who does conventions for a living, event planners, they're all not doing any business or very much business in Las Vegas. And that means thousands, tens of thousands of workers down there. When you take a step back from the scope of this project and revisiting people and finding out how they're doing over time, is effectively what you're trying to do is put, as somebody once said to me, put flesh to the data points. In other words, we always get all this information about how much unemployment, you know, all of this sort of statistical information, but sometimes it's easy to forget that there are actually, on every one of those data points, there's a human being on the other side.
Yes, that was absolutely the goal of the project. And I think in some ways that's compounded. Manny Fernandez wrote a beautiful essay to introduce the profiles. And he makes the point that, you know, this is a nameless crisis, one that we can't see. And I know from my own experience of just a bit of social starvation working remotely, I think that a lot of people care and would want to know and help in their communities. And it's actually just much harder to get firsthand observation, or, you know, just the thing you do at the before or after a meeting where you hear from a colleague about a friend or a relative or a story they heard. That's the layer of our individual community building that is missing right now. And I think these stories kind of try to help give shape to a crisis that's really going on in the background for a lot of people.
Clinton, one last question before I let you go. When you were editing this and when you were talking to all of the reporters involved in this project, what was the most surprising thing to you?
You know, I was really struck by, and I should stress that I really worked with all of the journalists across the 11 other newsrooms that we partnered with, but had excellent co-editors internally at the Times. I was struck by the fact that actually during the course of the reporting, I would get, you know, I would send a check-in note to one or another person and get a bounce back that said, you know, this reporter is on furlough this week. We'll get back to you when I'm back in the office. And that the same forces that are playing out in all of these stories are happening to the news industry and to local journalism in particular. And so I really felt that not only were we benefiting from the local expertise that a lot of these organizations have and the authority that they have in their communities, but that we were dealing with people who really understood at the community level in a granular way what was at stake. And I just felt so privileged to get to be working with these people and to be lifting up their voices.
That is Clinton Cargill, Assistant National Editor, New York Times. He was the editor on Out of Work in America, partnership with 11 news outlets to show individual stories about how the pandemic and unemployment are affecting people across the United States. Clinton, I want to thank you so much. It's a fantastic project. Thank you so much for joining Cairo Nights.
Thank you for having me. It was a real pleasure.
And coming up, we'll talk a little bit about the fact that, yeah, the economy is lousy right now. And depending on where you live, it's not going to get any better. But it looks like there are some big U.S. companies that are going to be doing at least some seasonal hiring over the next couple of months. And it may be a way, if you are struggling, to augment your income with a little bit of seasonal work right after the break. Welcome back to Cairo Nights. You might have been, if you were listening to the prior segment, we interviewed Assistant National Editor at the New York Times, Clinton Cargill. And the Times did this really remarkable package of stories out of work in America. They coordinated with 11 local news outlets and had people tell their stories of how the pandemic is affecting them and how being out of work is affecting them. And don't assume that this is just going to be a series of tragic vignettes about people losing work. This is actually a series about resilience and about what is a fundamentally American quality of having hopefulness, even when things feel at their worst. I could not more highly recommend reading it. And if you didn't catch the interview, we'll have that posted. Cairo Nights podcast, if you do the search for that, you will find it there. And also potentially on My Northwest as well. But given the theme of what we were talking about, I wanted to add a little bit of potentially good news or relief for anybody who identifies with those folks and feels like they are running low on unemployment benefits. They've run out of unemployment benefits. They're worried about their own job going on furlough or going away entirely. There is some good news. This is going to be this isn't maybe your perfect dream career, but on the other hand, it may well could be. So the news from Amazon is fairly significant right now, and it's this. Amazon, and the Seattle Times reported this, but I think virtually everyone has GeekWire as well. It's a national story at this point. Amazon is filling 100,000 seasonal job openings as it ramps up for the holiday season. This is out of the Seattle Times. The company said on Tuesday, the commerce giant and its rivals and partners in online delivery such as UPS are emphasizing career opportunities that can grow from seasonal jobs. UPS is also trying to fill 100,000 seasonal openings with job fairs this weekend. More than a third of the U.S. workforce began in a seasonal job. And so these are really good opportunities. Now, I have a little bit of experience with the going to work for UPS. Back in 2000, when I got into Seattle, I got here. My timing couldn't have been better. And I mean that ironically. I get to the PI newsroom about, I'm still on, you know, probation while I'm here, but you're on 6 month probation when you go to work for Hearst newspapers. I'm maybe at month four in my probation when we reach a labor impasse and then we declare a strike. And for those of you in town, if you remember the newspaper strike, it was us and it was the Seattle Times because we were under at the time what's called a joint operating agreement, meaning that the business side was pooled. The newsrooms were separate and competitive, but the business side was one entity. And that's really what we were striking about. And so I'm here in Seattle. I've spent everything I have to get up here. I am now out of work with no ability to collect anything. There was, I think, a little bit of strike pay, although I don't remember ever getting access to that. And so what I did was, one, I was out on the picket line, and two, I was writing for our little strike newspaper, but three, I went to UPS and applied. And the funny thing about UPS, given that it is a union shop, and obviously we're a union on strike, and so that had some appeal to me, but also that was one of the jobs, and I don't know, I would think that my mom would have had a lot of ambition for me, but she was a union secretary, and so she always was trying to push me toward union work. We would not have had braces and great medical care and insurance benefits all the way through my childhood had it not been for my mom. My dad also worked very hard, but never in a situation where the benefits would flow from his work. And so from my mom, who was a Teamster secretary, stationary engineers secretary, labor council, ultimately secretary, she was the one who kept us in really good medical, dental, eye care, all of that sort of stuff. And so she was really fixated on the idea of going to work for a union when I was a kid. And I ended up inadvertently doing that. I picked a journalism career. But in most of the shops where I worked, they were actually newspaper guild shops. And that was, to be completely candid, that was inadvertent. It was great because it provided good benefits, but mainly I picked papers where I really wanted to work and I felt like I could do a good job given the job. So I go apply for UPS. And at that particular point, we're starting to near a settlement, and UPS finally called me back for this seasonal work. And the day they called me back was the day they announced our settlement. And so I waited to see how long it was going to be before I would go back in the newsroom. It turned out it was very quickly. So I called them back and said, hey, I am sorry. Thank you for the job. I am not actually going to be showing up. And they said, fine, don't worry. We've got plenty of people on the list. And they did. So I literally got hired by UPS and never actually ended up going to work there. But I always thought, like, well, if I ever needed, you know, a part-time gig or something like that, and I have a member of my family is working for UPS right now, I would go there and load boxes or whatever they start you at. Usually, I'm assuming it's in the warehouse, and usually I'm assuming it's somehow the loading the boxes. You have to move up probably to get one of the driver gigs. But these are decent jobs. The Amazon warehouses, I know, have a reputation of being real, not necessarily sweatshops. They certainly have a paid minimum wage of $15 an hour. And my understanding is in some cases they've tried to, after a lot of bad publicity, they've tried to reform the way they handle their work internally. But Amazon is also going to put about 100,000 jobs out there. Now, I don't know how many that means necessarily for the fulfillment center in Kent or other Amazon jobs. My guess is that on a delivery end, they're going to need people, and on a warehouse end, they're going to need people. It wasn't specific here, but I would go online and I would check that out. UPS as well. FedEx, I would guess also. I mean, all of these companies that are going to be both that are essentially joined at the hip with Amazon are definitely going to be needing to make a whole bunch of hires in the holiday season. And before I forget, of course, you know, if the UPS is hiring and FedEx is hiring and Amazon is hiring, of course, the United States Postal Service is also hiring at this particular point. So for those of you who are looking to make a little bit of extra cash right now, those are three places to work that certainly pay at least minimum wage, if not better, and in many cases offer benefits. This may be a way to sort of get you through the holiday season, and who knows? I mean, UPS and FedEx and Amazon certainly say that they see these jobs not just as filler for seasonal, but as potential for additional longer-term work. And one more thing to add. So if you are anticipating that there is going to be a stimulus check anytime soon, I would hold off on that. It's obviously not going to happen before the election. And even then, it's going to take a while to ramp up. And you saw what happened with unemployment in Washington State. It was an abysmal showing. A little bit of delay makes some sense. The unusual number of people who applied makes some sense. Let's give them a month or two leeway on that. But how awful it was implemented, and then how slowly it was fixed and dealt with was pretty inexcusable. So there you go. Now there are some opportunities for people to actually get some employment during the critical holiday season and into the new year. That is about 200,000 jobs that are opening up nationally, and a whole bunch of those are going to be happening in Washington State as well. Coming up, the Random Question Robot right after the break. Welcome back to Cairo Nights. Join Cairo Radio and Seattle Radio Theater for a spooky evening this Thursday, October 29th, with the live and very creepy radio drama, A Walk in the Dark. Starting at 8 o'clock, Cairo Radio voices, including Frank Shires right here.
And you.
Will thrill, that's in me as well, will thrill and chill the whole family with a scary audio tale set in old-time Seattle. More info at mynorthwest.com/events. All right. We put it off as long as we could.
Yes.
It is time to match wits. Our three of them, it's many, with the Questatron 700. Shane?
Been ready all episode.
All right. Frank?
Never.
All right. That's what I want to hear. All right. What is the biggest personal change you've ever made, Frank?
A couple of times. I've lost a lot of weight in a short period of time. And it did make a really big change.
Well, yeah, it usually does.
Yeah, a couple of times. And it's just, I've been amazed every time it's happened. I need to do it again.
All right, Shane?
I don't know. I think probably the biggest change or thing that I've done in my life is just change the way that I learn, change the way that I look at school and how I look at just like work in general. I think when I was younger, I was very hesitant to really ever try to like apply myself to anything. So once I started figuring out that education was kind of the key to kind of expanding my life and my knowledge, that that's when I just made the change and just fully devoted myself to wanting to be a good student.
All right. Mine probably was, there's probably a few, but I would say the one most obvious one that popped into my head was my decision to move to Seattle. I had a gig that I really liked. I was around my family. I was around a lot of really close friends. It was difficult to actually pack up and move up here for what turned out to be a great gig at the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. But that was one of those definite massive pivot points. You kind of wonder what would have happened if you stayed. And honestly, I mean, I can't imagine my life if I hadn't moved up here. But I mean, in one sense, that was really one of those big crossroads that I think about a lot. All right, Shane, what two languages would you like to be fluent in?
I would love to be fluent in Italian. That is just a really cool language, and I think that it would be very useful if I was able to go over to Italy. And I don't know, if I had to learn another language, I think I would probably have to go with Spanish, because that would probably be the most useful.
Frank?
I would pick Spanish first, and then and these aren't even remotely connected, but I think it would be interesting to learn Chinese. I think it would be very difficult, and they don't share language trees, so.
No, I think so. But actually, so if I had to learn additional languages, I would probably pick, like you did, I'd pick Spanish and Mandarin. Because the way I look at it is, if you pick Spanish, Mandarin, and English, you got about 3.5, almost 4 billion people right there that you can annoy every day of the week. And who doesn't want that sort of privilege? That's probably what I would go to. All right, this one, I guess, is to me. Can't avoid it. What is the most interesting art you've seen? Well, I would say, actually, I'm going to go with a collection of art. Either of you heard of, you probably haven't heard of it, maybe you have, heard of Meow Wolf?
No.
I have not, no.
Right, Meow Wolf is one of the coolest things I've ever seen in art, period. It is worth a trip to Santa Fe. Meow Wolf is, and I think it was funded largely by George R.R. Martin, the guy who wrote the Game of Thrones books. It was an old bowling alley that they took and they subdivided it into this sort of walkthrough, kind of hands-on artistic adventure. And there's a story that's a mystery story that's being told depending on what direction you go through it. I mean, it literally is like a room that's like all, like you feel like you're in an Apollo capsule, other things that are like being underwater. It is, I'm not doing it justice. If you call up Meow Wolf on, from images, they let you take pictures in there. It is worth a trip to Santa Fe. You will spend hours in there. It is that fascinating.
I'm sorry I missed it.
Yeah. You were in Santa Fe?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You in particular, Frank, would have really dug it.
Yeah, I'm sure would have.
All right, what do you think?
I have the complete collection, not just some of the books, the complete bound collection of Calvin and Hobbes. And for my money, that man, Bill Watterson, was among the greatest artists to ever create a comic strip ever.
I completely agree with you.
Yeah.
I agree with you, too.
He's, you can go back to Walt Kelly, Pogo.
Yeah.
You can look at the simplicity of Peanuts, but when you really get down to this guy was just wonderful.
Everything he did, really, just spot on. I completely
amazing.
Agree. Shane?
I got really into Ralph Steadman when I was getting into Hunter S. Thompson. Still am into Hunter S. Thompson. I think he's amazing. But I think his art's just super wacky. It's kind of dark. It's kind of strange. It's a little trippy. It somewhat resembles a little bit of a reality that I think we all share. So I don't know. I think it's pretty interesting, and I love a lot of his illustrations, especially a lot of his stuff from Fear and Loathing that you know.
Well, remember to tell me too. I got a couple of pretty funny Hunter stories because my old boss at the PI, David McCumber, in fact, you can find David, one of Hunter's books is dedicated to David because David was Hunter's boss at the San Francisco Examiner.
That
must and be wild. Used to visit him out in Woody Creek, has many stories, but a couple of them, one's good for suitable for on air. some of the other, in fact, a great one is suitable for on air. So you ask me tomorrow and I'll give you a great Hunter Thompson story.
I will definitely remember that.
All right. Next one. Oh, are we out?
We got time for
We got we got a lightning round.
All right, lightning round. One word answer. What gets progressively weirder the more you think about it?
Life.
Fair enough.
Death.
Fair enough. I say time travel. All right.
That's two words.
Oh, sorry about that. I guess I cheated because I'm running the show. All right. Coming up, we've got Stacey Joe just around the corner. Guess what? We don't talk about sports at all. We talk about celebrities. Really. Seriously. After the break.